Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this evening's edition of the Global Math Department. My name is Lena Taro, and I will be your host tonight. Tonight, we are going to be hearing from Ethan Wecker about improving student discourse through debate in the math classroom. And I've already had a sneak peek at his slides, and I tell you, you are in for a very, very good session this evening. Would everybody please introduce themselves in the chat window, telling us what you teach, where, and what your Twitter handle is, if you have one. Before I introduce our speaker and turn the mic over to him, let me explain a little bit about how these meetings work. These meetings are recorded and are available a few hours after the meeting ends. To view the recording, you come back to the same URL that brought you here. The Global Math Department community prides itself on being friendly and supportive. The chat room is available for topical and general conversation throughout the meeting. I'll catch your questions for the presenter, so don't worry that he won't notice it in the chatter. Our speaker tonight is Ethan Wecker. Ethan teaches algebra, geometry, and pre-calculus at Mid Peninsula High School in Menlo Park, California. He's taught secondary mathematics since 2001, and much of his career has focused on students who learn differently. He speaks at state and national conferences about how to increase and improve student discourse in the math classroom. Ethan strives to make math accessible to all students and uses debate structures as means for helping students to get involved in passionate discussions about mathematical ideas. You can follow Ethan on Twitter at Ethan_midpen and read his blog at mathematiciansmusings.wordpress.com. Let's turn the microphone over to Ethan.
Hi, thanks so much. I'm really, really excited to be here. I'm really excited to share some of what I've been doing over the past few years, and hope that you'll be able to come away with this with some ideas that'll work in your classroom. So I'm going to start out just going way back to when I first started teaching. I thought when I first started out in the classroom, I was doing the most amazing and exciting things. And now I look back and realize I was nothing more than a basic lecturer. I tried to move away from that and towards more student-driven discussion and activities, and I struggled. My students struggled. I was used to one way of teaching. My students were used to that same way of learning. So when I tried to have a class discussion, those discussions were often silent, or they were between me and the two or three students in the class who had previously felt successful in math classes. And they were willing to do what I wanted because it was all just part of the game of school. I brought in fun activities, baking examples, historical examples, racing, model rockets. But in the end, it was still a class led by me, and I was the one doing most of the talking, and I knew something had to change. So I was working at a school primarily for students with learning disabilities or learning differences. And for much of my career, I've had a focus on students on the autism spectrum, students who on the surface appear to have significant deficits or challenges with communication. I don't have a special ed credential, but I did a lot of research in my early years of teaching. And for 5 years, I taught at a school that's expressly for students who've been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, NLD, or related disabilities. Through my work with some amazing psychologists in the field, I came to realize how important structure could be to help some students, help those students communicate their ideas. It's through some of those ideas that I started to incorporate debate into my classroom. Over the past several years, the amount of time that I've spent developing the procedures for debates in the math classroom has grown, and I've seen those structures benefit all students, the ones with anxiety, the ones who insisted they weren't math people, the ones who didn't fit in because they didn't fit a stereotype. And I hear a lot of students talk about the stereotypes of white students being the math ones or Asian students being the math ones. And many students of color, many girls don't see themselves as being able to identify as a mathematician. I'm not gonna pretend that debates is a magic bullet. It's not as if I've discovered this one key to equity in math education. But I have seen its impact in my own classroom, and I've heard back from many other teachers that they've seen its benefits as well. So I hope that you too will find a way to use some of these debate structures in your own classroom. And you'll be otherwise inspired to take some of these ideas and run with them. If you do, please make sure to share them with us, with our whole community. I certainly would love to keep adding new ideas. So I've done a lot of thinking about debate and talking about debates over the years, and it's become a bigger and bigger issue. Last fall, I got a tweet from Annie Fetter. This was a tweet about a New York Times article, and I've got a link to this in one of my, the documents that I'll share at the end. And it's a tweet, or it's an article about the importance of encouraging or allowing students to fight, allowing kids to fight. And it is a hard thing to let happen. We want students to get along. We want our kids to get along. I always kind of cringe when I hear my two daughters, they're 3 and 6, and they start fighting. And my first instinct is always to get them to stop fighting. But there's this really nice little quote here that I put up from this article. The skill to get hot without getting mad, to have a good argument that doesn't become personal, is critical in life. But it's one that few parents teach to their children. We want to give kids a stable home, so we stop siblings from quarreling and we have our own arguments behind closed doors. Yet, if kids never get exposed to disagreement, we end up limiting their creativity. And this is absolutely something that I have seen in the math classroom. When I tell students that I want them to tap into some creativity, tap into their creative minds and creative thought process, they often look at me funny because this is a math classroom and that's not a place for creativity. It's a place for right answers and wrong answers and no gray area. And I think it's really important to illustrate to them the importance of disagreement and critiquing ideas. It's a critical part of our whole endeavor in teaching math and teaching where it fits in and how it can be used. So why debate math, right? I mean, well, why debate in the first place? We have all of these abilities to put some structure around arguing. And with these four rules that the article mentioned, and I actually really like these rules, and I've incorporated these into my debate practice in the classroom, it helps us to give students a way to argue without taking things personally, hopefully. So the first rule is to frame it as a debate rather than a conflict. You can have a debate, a disagreement with someone without making it personal. Argue as if you're right, but listen as if you're wrong. In my school, we have a once a week in our homeroom, we have a thing called a council. And within the council, we have one question that is posed, and around the circle, everyone has one opportunity to answer. And it also means that as we go around, it gives us a good opportunity to work on listening skills, work on hearing what other people say. And this lends itself well to the debate structure as well. It's important to listen as if you might actually change your mind, and that's okay. The third rule here is make the most respectful interpretation of the other person's perspective, assuming that the other person actually has a good reason for the things that they're saying. They may not be right, you may disagree with them, but in their minds, they have a really good, really strong argument to make. And the fourth rule here, acknowledge where you agree with your critics and what you've learned from them. You can completely disagree with the main premise, but your critic might have some really good supporting arguments. And those really great supporting arguments might help you understand a little bit better the issue as a whole. So this is all great and all, but where does it fit in a math classroom? Why debate math in the first place? Well, if we go back to the math practices, math practice three, it's a really nice little paragraph that describes it. I'd like to just read this out to you. Mathematically proficient students understand and use stated assumptions, definitions, and previously established results in constructing arguments. They make conjectures and build a logical progression of statements to explore the truth of their conjectures. They're able to analyze situations by breaking them into cases and can recognize and use counterexamples. They justify their conclusions, communicate them to others, and respond to the arguments of others. They reason inductively about data. They make plausible arguments that take into account the context from which the data arose. Mathematically proficient students are also able to compare the effectiveness of two plausible arguments, distinguish correct logic or reasoning from that which is flawed, and if there's a flaw in an argument, explain what it is. So it does go on, but it basically sounds like it's a description of debate. That's really what it is. Students at all grade levels can do this. They can listen to and read what others have argued. They can decide whether they make sense, where they make sense. They can ask questions to clarify the ideas, clarify the arguments, improve their arguments. So I want to just go into the chat room now and just do a quick little sample debate. Just starting off with this really quick question, what's your favorite number? This is actually how I start my classes every year with the what's your favorite number debate. I'm gonna do it a little bit differently here than what I would normally do. Normally I do this in what I call a pairs debate or growing pairs debate, and it's a really fun structure. But here, just in the chat window, go ahead and give your favorite number and one reason why you think it's your favorite number. So one thing that's a lot of fun to do is look back at what most of your answers are, because what I see a lot of is I see a lot of reasons that it's behind reasons behind your favorite numbers that are very math oriented. Things about products or prime numbers, factors, things like that. And yet, Amber Hecker has this great reason for 18 being her favorite number. It was an old sports jersey number of mine. One of the great things about this kind of debate is it allows every single student to have an entry point here. It is so much fun to start to hear students on their first day talk about their favorite numbers because you get a sense of who a student is a lot more than you ever would have imagined. So the next step here, if we were going to do debate and we can do this a little bit, is if you've already given a reason for your number being so great, the next thing to do is take it a little bit further and see if you can bump your number up a little bit in everyone's mind. So there are two ways of doing that. You can talk about why your number is really, really great, or you can talk about why someone else's number isn't as great as they thought. One thing that I usually do, and I do this a little bit later in the year because I want to keep that first day as low on structure as possible. But I generally do a yes and or yes but debate. And that means that every statement after the first one starts with the phrase yes and or yes but. And this allows every student to acknowledge someone else's argument instead of just dismissing it. So, for example, let's see, Sherry talked about 12 being a great number because of doubling and halving. But what makes, so we could take that and we could start talking about all these negative things about it. But instead of just doing that, I'm going to say, yes, 12 can be doubled and it can be halved, and that's pretty great. But 24 can be doubled and halved as well. And it can be doubled and halved more times. And for that matter, so could 48 and 96 and 512. So you can start to agree with someone and then use their argument to sort of build some other mathematical thinking behind it. So I definitely really enjoy this. It is something that my students will sometimes ask to do partway through the year too. Can we have a new favorite number debate? I have some new ideas. So it's a lot of fun to see students who maybe in the past didn't prepare themselves to enjoy a math class to come in that very first day and have a lot of fun. And it opens them up to being ready to have fun all the way through the year. Even on those days when sometimes it just isn't as much fun. So there are a lot of different of these informal kind of debates. Some of these I'll use for some, like warm-ups or closing activities, things like that. Let's see. So the next thing I want to kind of talk about is debate topics. And one of the debate topics that comes up, this is this very first one that I just talked about. What's your favorite number? Debate topics can really come from anywhere, though. They can come from everything. I use a year of end review to kind of go through what are all of the concepts that we've covered and where is there some possible controversy. And I've attached a PDF of a spreadsheet that I've got in a Google spreadsheet. And that's available at the end. There's a link to it. So hopefully people will check it out and give some comments so we can add to it. I'd love to take some additional suggestions in there and really kind of build this up. But really, I look for engaging topics. In geometry class, we just had a really fun debate on, are proofs actually necessary? Do we need to prove things in math, or is it just good enough to know how to do it? In my trig class, my pre-calc class, we often have a really fun debate about, should we use radians or degrees? And we can do a similar debate in my geometry class. In fact, we did one earlier this year on, should we change the way we measure degrees from 360 degrees, which is nice and traditional, and 360 has lots of factors, it's what we've always used, or should we go to a decimal system where 100 degrees makes a circle, and that way every degree measure ends up being a percentage of the circle. So 25% of the circle, instead of being 90 degrees, now it's 25 degrees. So they had a really fun time kind of playing around with that idea and had a really fun debate with that. In my algebra class every year, we have this really fun debate over systems of linear equations and how to solve them. Should they be solved with substitution? Should they be solved with elimination? Should they be solved by graphing? And it almost doesn't matter too much what your general topic is. The best debate questions end up being questions where the answer is really, it depends. One of the things that I have found is that students will ask me why we do something some way. Why is it that we do a particular procedure or algorithm in one manner? And maybe the way that we have always taught it, maybe the way that we've always done it isn't good enough. Anytime that students question me about why we do something some way, it's a good trigger for a debate topic. Not always gonna work out, but it often does. I've got a few questions here. Which one of these makes good debate questions? Are all even numbers divisible by 2? Should we use a linear model to describe projectile motion? Do all triangles have 3 sides? I would say all of those are pretty lousy debate questions. They're just yes or no answers, and they have a very definite answer. On the other hand, is mean or median a better way to describe salaries? And we get into really interesting, big conversations once we start talking about how we can apply an idea in math to a real world situation. One avenue that I found is amazing for this that I've really kind of taken on in this past year has been Mathalicious. So if you get a chance to play around with Mathalicious, they have got some really outstanding activities. And I absolutely have found that those kind of activities generate really, really rich discussions. We had a really, really great one in my algebra classes where we did a whole activity that was about minimum wage and what it should be and should it be increased or not. And students came away from that with some debates in class. And after the debates, they decided that they want to actually do a little bit more research and put together a presentation based on math to go to the local city council and make an argument to possibly change or increase minimum wage. So it's really exciting to see students come away from a debate with something actionable, something that they can use and that they take ownership of. Should angles be measured by degrees or radians? Again, it's one of the big topics that I do in my pre-calc class. And it's funny because I've done it early in the year and late in the year. And the later in the year I have done it, the more students really appreciate radian measure. Should trapezoids be defined as having exactly or at least one pair of parallel sides? This particular debate has been a really, really fun one to listen to how my students argue, how they research, help them out with their research, and help them take some ideas and really go with them. So this is probably a good point where I'm going to take a moment and hopefully this will work out the way I want it to, but I want to share with you a little bit of a video from one of my geometry classes. So let's see if I can bring this up. I thought I had preloaded them and it didn't seem to load what I thought had been loaded up. So let me grab that URL and bring it over. So this is from earlier this year. My geometry classes were talking about whether proofs should be a necessary part of mathematics, or whether it's just good enough to know something that's true. And they get into some pretty heady stuff here. So let me go ahead and play this clip. It's about 2.5 minutes. I might cut it short. We'll see what the timing is like. But I also can share links to these at the end.
This question is aimed at the con slide. So, picture the idea of that 1 + 1 = 2, and that here's the idea. We've solved. Why should we have to go the extra step of proving it? Rather than just have it as a postulate, 1 + 1 = 2, and just accept it. Why should we have to prove it?
I think that we should have to prove it because you always want it to be true. So if it works for one thing, it might not work for another. So we just want to make sure it's always true. Any rebuttal?
Can we go for to the slide number one, please? I mean number two, I guess. Do you really think that we need all of that to prove that 1 + 1 = 2? Do you even get what it said there? Because I don't really know. I'm not sure that the other team has any idea of how that works.
I think they're showing 1 = 2.
Hansai, do you have any counter response to that?
Well, first of all, our understanding of that math problem does not prove or disprove anything. Second of all, while I admit it's not immediately necessary for people to understand that, if we can't explain why we think something, then we have no basis for thinking in the first place.
So would you explain that to us, please, because I did.
I'm going to deduct 0.2 points for interrupting the side without having the floor given to you.
Okay.
Sorry. Whether or not I can understand this has no bearing on the truth of my argument or the truth of your argument.
Are there any counter rebuttals from the pro side?
I think if it's not understandable, it shouldn't be required to be taught or known by anyone, really.
All right.
Okay, so I'll comment now on the debate structure. And one thing that I think is really important to acknowledge here is I have, I lost the presentation. Let's see if we can get that. In the meantime, let's see. Oh, there we go. Thank you. Let's see if we can. There we go. Okay. Thank you. All right. So I'm very fortunate because I do teach in a school. It's a private school with smaller classes. And as a result, I don't have a lot of students sitting out. In this particular class, I had two teams of four sitting side by or facing each other. And then I have a team of moderators, and those are sitting at the front. They actually have full control over the screen that's projected. And for the other students that are sitting out at this point, so for this particular class, I had about eight students sitting out. We actually had two debates. So when we have two debates going on, it just means that the first half of the debate, the class is one debate, the second half of the class is the second debate. I also have had classes where we've had two formal debates per semester, and all students had to participate in one of those formal debates. So if they weren't in the first one, they'd be in the second one. There are definitely a lot of different structures where you can have everyone involved a lot more. And those would be a lot more informal debates. And we're gonna get to those in just a moment. Okay, so let's go to our next screen here, because I wanna talk about some of those informal debate structures. I don't know if you're familiar with the Would You Rather website. This is, I think, John Stevens' website. And he has a whole list of amazing, really quick questions that can be asked. And they can take up 5 minutes or they can take up an entire class period. And it gives just a really nice structure to allow students to make some arguments before they've done any math and then start doing the math to kind of weigh out which argument makes the most sense. The example that I have here, you and a friend want to share a treat equally. Would you rather share plate A or plate B? And you can see plate A, you have three small cookies, and plate B is one large cookie. And either way, someone might be unhappy. So how would you share it equally, which is going to make things the most easy? This is actually one that I gave my geometry class fairly recently. And their initial ideas or their additional initial thoughts were really, really interesting. And some of them were really creative. I think my favorite one was the student who said, it really doesn't matter. You just crush the cookies and then divide them into two equal piles of crumbs. So students have a lot of fun with all sorts of different would you rather questions. Another informal debate structure that I use is I use which one doesn't belong. And on the left here, I have a which one doesn't belong that I created as a simple warm-up for my geometry class. And in my geometry class, I allowed students to, in their groups, so I had three groups of students, and they each had to pick one and come up with a few reasons of why it does or doesn't belong. And then we just did what I call a round-robin debate, where we would just go around from one group to the next, and each group would make an argument in favor of the drawing or figure that they felt didn't belong, or an argument against one of the other ones. And as you can see, there was a lot written for the two on the right, B and D, and some really, really creative stuff. It's a little hard to read my writing probably because students were firing ideas at me left and right really quickly. I thought this was gonna be a 5-minute warm-up, and it turned into a 45-minute discussion, and we didn't get to my lesson. And yet it didn't matter because we had students who were engaged. I had students who were excited, students who were ready to think and share ideas and listen to each other and get really creative. And those students who thought, oh, we're wasting Ethan's time and he's not going to get to his lesson and we're going to have so much fun, the trick was on them. They did 45 minutes of really interesting math discussion, came out of it with a really solid understanding of different angles and segments that can be found in circles and their relationships. And I didn't come close to sharing everything that got posted. I think we went over this diagram about 5 or 6 different times. The next day, the lesson that I was going to teach the day that this had come up, taught that lesson in about half the time that I normally would, because they already basically knew everything that was going on. There was really nothing more I had to say. So like I said, I've got a lot of different informal debate structures. And in the background here, you can see students that were doing a three-way debate. And this was a really interesting debate structure where students are basically, normally it's two lines of students that are facing each other. And in this format, which I call like a growing snakes format, I call it this just from the really old computer game Snake, where you've got a little snake and it's going around trying to eat something and you don't want it to bump into itself. Anyway, the way that this works normally is students are assigned to two different sides of a debate. This was our debate on solving systems of linear equations. And in this particular format, whichever student is in the front of the line makes their argument. The student facing them does a yes but statement, kind of like I talked about previously. They say yes but, and then they make their statement. As soon as they've made their statement to that first student, the first student who has heard whatever the comment was or whatever the argument was, they then go back to the end of either their line or the other line. So it allows students to change their mind, and they can change their minds multiple times over the course of a debate. And in this particular debate, we had three groups. So we had students arguing for elimination, graphing, and substitution. And by the end of the debate, strangely enough, substitution was gone, and it ended up being two students arguing really, really strongly in favor of graphing, and the rest of the class arguing for elimination. And again, what I had planned for as a 20-minute review kind of debate of what each of these topics was turned into a full class period that ended up being the best review that we could have ever done. Students had done some preparation, had done some research beforehand, and they were encouraged to come in with examples. And many of them didn't actually do all of the preparation that they should have done. And yet on the fly, they were able to create examples and show really good evidence of their thinking, of their reasoning, for which side of the debate they were arguing for, or which side they were arguing against. So even though some of these do appear to take a lot of research and a lot of time outside of class, one thing that I often strive for is a means to make sure that everyone can be involved, no matter how well or how poorly prepared they may have been. And I'll give some other examples of that. And one of the ways that I use technology is to sort of improve that process as well. Also, just want to mention, I talked about formal debates, showed a little bit of that image of a formal debate earlier. And all of the videos that I have end up being of formal debates. I took some video last week of that snakes debate that I just had that picture of, about linear substitution, and just wasn't, didn't work out. But interestingly, I looked online just for a quick clip art of formal debates or debate clubs or students debating, and all I found were white males. This clip art on this page was the only clip art that I saw that was possibly not two white males, and even then it was hard to tell. So I thought that was just a really interesting side note that I thought was worth mentioning. So formal debates do have a pretty strict structure, and it's not the same exact rules as you would find in a debate club. And yet students do really, really well with a lot of rules. So I've posted a couple of documents, and one is with informal debate structures and one with formal debate structures. And the formal debate structures have points involved, and they have timers involved and things like that. So we do keep things pretty strict there. But within that strictness, within that structure, comes a lot more clarity. It does require, again, more preparation, but it's a lot of fun as well. So I mentioned earlier, and I'm going to go ahead to here, I mentioned earlier that we use technology a lot in my classes. This is an Algebra 1 linear systems debate. This is actually not from this year, from last year. And I'm going to show this video as well. And I have the suspicion that when I do this, I'm going to lose the presentation, but hopefully it'll work out okay. So let's bring up this debate, and I'll also include the URL here in the comments. So there's the URL, and let me bring it up here so you can see what's going on. All right.
We, the math students of Algebra 1, believe that the elimination method is the superior method of solving algebraic systems of equations. The elimination method is less complicated, doesn't use fractions, and is generally easier. And as Ethan says, mathematicians are lazy. It doesn't require complicated distributing like the substitution method would.
We can eliminate variables early off in the problem.
Fractions aren't used as much as in substitution. And once you've found your first variable, it's very easy to find the other one.
It's a lot easier than graphing a ton of little points.
Substitution method becomes very tedious if there are many variables to complicate equations, while in elimination, you eliminate those variables.
Elimination method is far more efficient than substitution.
Elimination is easier than substitution for solving systems of equations.
Substitution is very involved and in-depth, which makes elimination much simpler and saves you time.
If you have two equations with four or five variables in each in them, it can be helpful to eliminate two or three or four of those variables at once to simplify the equation.
It's much easier to eliminate one of the variables in elimination than substitution.
So again, yeah, I just posted. That's the opening statement there from this debate. And I also posted in here, but students are using this shared Google Doc, and it allows them to prepare in advance to collaborate really nicely. And it allows me to kind of watch what they're doing and help out, give some pointers, and allow them to really build with me sort of pointing in the right direction sometimes. I also mentioned they've got this chat window open on the side, and it doesn't have to be through Google. There are certainly other avenues, but we just happen to have Google at our school for everything, so it does make things easier. But having that Google chat window is really nice because they're able to come up with strategies when their opposing side is making arguments. They're able to say, hey, so-and-so is talking about this thing, you should use this example. This has also been really, really helpful for when I've got students who are English language learners who maybe they don't feel confident when they're speaking, but they feel better writing, or vice versa, they don't feel confident typing out their ideas. But if someone has typed them out, then they feel okay with reading them and making them their own. So that really kind of improves some of the equity. And it's been really nice watching students of different backgrounds collaborate. Next thing I want to kind of briefly talk about is evaluation and assessment. And I evaluate moderators and debate teams as a group grade. This is something I actually have done for my group projects for quite some time. I grade everything individually, or every component individually within the whole group. For example, the debate group on the right-hand side, it's going to be out of 100 points, and I've got all these different categories that I grade them on. And I've got a rubric that I adapt for every class as well. So it's going to be out of 100 points. Well, suppose this was a group of four students. Well, they get 90 points out of 100, but then I multiply it by four, so there'd be 360 pooled points. And the students come to consensus on how many points each student gets. Now, more often than not, they end up dividing the points evenly. However, more often than not, what I've seen is that in my group projects, students don't tend to shirk responsibilities the way they once did. That student who used to kind of sit around and hope that he was in the project with the really, really good students would kind of cruise and get an A while everyone else did all the work. Well, he knows that he can't do that anymore. That student who always did all the work, well, now she knows she doesn't have to take over the whole project. If she's doing everything that she should be doing, she's going to get a good grade. And as a result, students divide that work a lot more evenly. In fact, the only times I've ever had discrepancies and arguments where I've had to step in have been where a student insists that they should be getting a lower score than everyone else. So it's backwards from maybe how I would have expected, but it so far has worked out really well. Now, I know it might not work in every school. I know there are often concerns about bullying students into even distribution of points or even giving out more points for someone who maybe didn't do as much work. I have not seen that. And again, that might be a factor of the classroom environment, the small class sizes. There might be a whole bunch of different factors there. But I've been really fortunate to see it work out well. So I've also got some examples here of some of the rubrics that I use. And again, these are saved at the end. I don't want to take too much time here. And we already saw this debate, so I'm going to move back to talk about technology use. I know we're running close to the end here, and I want to make sure that if there's any time, if there's some time for questions, I can take care of addressing those. So for research, like I said, we do a lot with Google. So mostly we use Google Docs. I've definitely had students who prefer using Google Keep within their group. And it's something that they like to access on their phone. In some ways, it's a little bit nicer than Google Docs. It's a little bit easier to format certain things. Students have also expressed interest in using OneNote or Evernote, and I know other teachers have been really successful using those programs as well. During the debate, either Google Slides or PowerPoint or Keynote has been used to project different things. And usually what's projected are images that students have uploaded in advance, and those will be handled by the moderator. So you saw in the geometry debate, one of the students requested slide 2. Everyone has access to upload slides to that, and it also means that both sides of the debate are able to see each other's visual evidence. We also use things like GeoGebra and Desmos for graphing, and that sometimes comes up for dynamic graphs that students might use during a debate to illustrate an idea. I already mentioned we use Google Hangouts and the Google Chat within the Google Docs document. And sometimes we've had students use Skype. And in fact, I had a student who was on vacation for the holiday break. He left a week early because he was going to China. On the way, he was in, I think, Canada when we were actually having our debate, and Skyped in so that he could join in. So there's a lot of ability to use communication to allow students to take part in various different ways. For scoring, I set up a Google form usually, and I often invite students from other classes and other faculty members and staff to come in and check out the debate as it's going on. And I'll usually put up a QR code so that they can scan that as they come in, and it gives them access to a score sheet. And then they're able to provide scores at the end, and we can determine who wins and who loses the debate that way. Or as I usually say, who wins and who comes in second. And for feedback, because I think it's really important, I give feedback to my students on their Google Docs as they're going through the research process and at the end through comments and through Google Forms. They give me feedback on what went well for them and what didn't and what they'd like to change. And then I also use Google Classroom to assign our debates and our debate topics and things like that. So there's not really enough time, I know, to show this last clip. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to just post the link here. And give you the opportunity, if you'd like, to check it out a little bit later. This is a clip from a pre-calculus class where they were discussing whether to use discrete graphs or continuous graphs to make a point. And this was a debate that we did as a formal debate, but at the very beginning of the year, this would have been 1 or 2 years ago. And these were students who, most of them had had me previously in a geometry class, so they were pretty familiar with debate structures. And this was as we were in our opening unit talking about functions and how to make sense of functions. And this debate was all about, once you are doing some sort of modeling with functions, if you're going to present this data somehow to an audience, is it better to use discrete points, or is it better to fit a curve and give the graph of the curve, which makes more sense? And it allowed students to really get really involved in the whole idea of what it means to communicate mathematically, both in the debate itself, but also in using math later on to make make their ideas known. So the last slide I have here, I had mentioned that I have some resources. So I've put some PDFs of these as they stand right now in the handout section, but there are 5 documents that are fully available for you to access online. And they're available in a Google Doc, or the Math Debate Topics is actually a spreadsheet. And you should be able to make comments there. But if you have other ideas, you can certainly just email me, or you can reach me on Twitter. And I think both all of that information is available here. And I do see here now a question about how frequently I utilize debate. So thanks, Cheryl. Yeah, I do formal debates actually about twice a semester, depending on the class. As we get further on, it's about twice a semester. Algebra 1, I do it about once a semester. Informal debates happen on a weekly basis, at least. Sometimes it is something as simple as a which one doesn't belong activity, where students will get into corners, because which one doesn't belong is generally going to have 4 different options. So we have 4 corners of my classroom, and students move into those corners, and then we I set up a spinner to randomly pick names, and students, when their name is picked, give an argument either for their corner or against another corner. And then students can switch corners regularly. And we'll do that for about 5 minutes. So that's a pretty regular sort of warm-up activity that I'll do, or closing activity that I'll do. Often we will just have a debate, an impromptu debate in class when something comes up. Informal debates, I think, are as important or more important than the formal debates. They're a little more unstructured, but a lot more organic. And it allows you to see students' thinking process, whereas the formal debates tend to give you a chance to see more of the refined final product of what a student has come up with and thought about. So I don't know if there are other questions out there, but hopefully this has been helpful for everyone.
I don't see any other questions, but I just wanted to say thank you for a wonderful presentation. I definitely have to look into the resources that you have listed here in more detail. If there's any more questions for Ethan, feel free to post them in the chat window, or you can stick around for a moment after the session's fully over. Just to let you know, next week we have review days, review packets, test prep worksheets, blah. It's a webinar that will focus on alternate ways to review for assessments and to review with your students. So thank you again, Ethan, for a wonderful session this evening.
All right, thank you very much. I really appreciate this opportunity and hope that everyone is able to get something out of it. And again, feel free to tweet at me and see what I can do to help you out. If you do go ahead and use these debates, let me know how it goes. I'm always really excited to hear about how students are getting better at arguing.
Okay.